Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Stuttered Kennedy. Chapter 44. Widening Recognition. With the fading out of the hue and cry which supervened on the Woodbury libel suits and the Woodbury articles in the arena, there followed three or four undisturbed years. As far as the outside public was concerned, the articles in the arena had overstepped the mark. Their malicious intent was apparent, and the rapid growth of Christian Science all over the world, but especially in the United States, and the respect which it was gaining, resulted in the attacks upon it having, in many cases, the reverse effect of what was intended. On any issue which really attracts public interest, the demand for good sportsmanship on both sides becomes more insistent, and the attacks on Christian Science, especially on its founder, began to savor more and more of bad sportsmanship. The general public, moreover, was, as always, interested in success. And every day that passed showed the Christian Science movement more successful. And so the years 1901 to 1906 were years of quiet, both as far as Mrs. Eddy personally was concerned and her teaching. Christian Science lectures became periodic features of public life in most cities, large and small. And some Christian Science lecturers, like Edward A. Kimball, became famous for their eloquence and the convincing nature of their presentation. They attracted large audiences and could command almost unlimited space in the daily press. Edward A. Kimball, who has already appeared several times in this record, was perhaps the most outstanding instance of really effective apostleship. Born in Buffalo, New York, on August 27, 1845, he was a lineal descendant of one Richard Kimball, an Englishman of gentle birth, who landed in New England in 1684. Edward's father died when he was 3 years old, and the support and care of the children, two sons and two daughters, devolved upon the mother, Elvira St. John Kimball. She seems to have been a remarkable woman, one of those rare people who combined a cultured, sensitive mind with a simple capacity for management, such as enabled her to raise her family and afford them more than ordinary opportunities for advancement. Edward got to work early. At the age of 17, after attending public schools in Buffalo, he moved to Saginaw, Michigan, and soon afterwards went on to Chicago. There he got a job as bookkeeper with a firm of manufacturers, and rose speedily in their employ until he became a partner in the firm. In the early 80s, both he and his wife, he had married in 1873, suffered from persistent ill health, and they both seem to have heard of Christian Science about the same time, though through different channels. Mrs. Kimball was healed almost at once. Edward was not so fortunate. It was fully a year before he finally got relief. When he did, however, it was complete, And thereafter, both he and his wife took up the study of the new teaching with devotion. As already recorded, they sought and obtained instruction from Mrs. Eddy in 1888, being members of the historic class, which met in Boston after Mrs. Eddy's return from Chicago, and just before she took decision to dissolve her college and church and seek retirement in Concord. 10 years later, they were members of Mrs. Eddy's last class, the one she taught in Concord in the November of 1898. Kimball was then a lecturer and a member of the Board of Education, and recognized as one of the ablest men in the movement. In the latter years of his life as a lecturer, he could apparently fill any hall of any size in any part of the world. In these years, Edward Kimball and his fellow lecturers carried their message everywhere. And from time to time, there would come out of Pleasant View a word of commendation published in the Journal or Sentinel for this one or that one who had done well. And Mrs. Eddy's "well done" had come to mean much. Another important move at this time was the resumption of the practice of certifying teachers. The Massachusetts Metaphysical College, it will be remembered, had been dissolved in 1889 and its charter surrendered. The state law under which the college was chartered originally had since been revoked, and it became necessary to set up a different arrangement. Accordingly, Mrs. Eddy issued a new bylaw in 1899, creating a Board of Education to be constituted of three of her appointees and authorized to send out 21 teachers annually. Later, the number was changed to 30 triennially. Edward A. Kimball was designated to teach the first class under the new auspices. Indeed, he was to continue in this office for 5 years. And Mrs. Eddy was to publicly declare, after his passing, that his clear, correct teaching of Christian Science has been and is an inspiration to the whole field. Still, another step was the establishment on an orderly footing of what was later known as the Committee on Publication. Ever since its first appearing, as has been seen, Christian Science had been subject to attack in the public press. It had, invariably, found a great cloud of defenders, always earnest, but not always judicious. And in many cases, it had much need of being delivered from its friends. As the teaching spread, it became clear that its defense was better left to those who really understood the subject and could deal with objections after knowledge rather than after zeal. And so it became the custom to appoint in different centers a committee to correct in every possible way, but especially by means of open letters to the press or private letters to editors, all utterances that were regarded as misstatements of Christian Science. It was also his duty to send reports to headquarters in Boston of any developments affecting the movement, and especially to aid practitioners who became involved in difficulties with medical doctors and others, as they often did in the early days. The Office of Committee was to develop into a base for concerted action more and more as the years rolled on, for the committee could instantly bring effective pressure to bear on editors and legislators through floods of officially inspired letters, and could well nigh swamp with protests any hapless bookseller who undertook to handle literature which the church authorities deemed objectionable. Meanwhile, as the great organization, for so it was by this time, was perfecting itself, Mrs. Eddy, in her retirement at Pleasant View, was keeping track of it all, and seeking at every turn to safeguard it against the obvious danger to all organizations, namely materialization. When New York built and dedicated a magnificent church, at the time it was one of the finest ecclesiastical structures in the country, Mrs. Eddy, in her dedicatory message, bade its members always to keep before them that the letter of their work must die, as do all things material, but the spirit of it is immortal. Remember, she added, that a temple but foreshadows the idea of God, the house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens, while a silent, grand man or woman, healing sickness and destroying sin, builds that which reaches heaven. It was in these years, too, that a pilgrimage to Concord, at the time of the annual meeting of the Mother Church, tended to become one of the most eagerly anticipated privileges of those journeying to Boston for the annual gatherings. Mrs. Eddy did not issue invitations every year, and ultimately ceased to issue them at all, seeking, as she did persistently at this time, to check the all-too-vigorous tendency to focus on her personality. She was, however, constantly torn between a sympathy with those who naturally desired to see her from motives of gratitude and genuine human affection, and disapproval of the unwholesome adulation with which she was continually burdened. The great gathering of 1898, already described, was several times repeated. In June 1903, no fewer than 10,000 people journeyed from Boston to Concord and spread themselves over the lawns at Pleasant View and were addressed briefly by Mrs. Eddy from the balcony outside her tower window. In 1903, she was 82 years of age, as slim and erect as ever, with a voice to the strength and beauty of which Arthur Brisbane, some 5 years later, still was to testify. It carried her brief address to the utmost limits of the great crowd. There are several records of the scene at the gathering. When Mrs. Eddy came out onto the balcony, she stood for a moment, looking out over the throng, and then, stretching out her hands with a characteristic gesture, bade them welcome to your home in my heart. Welcome to Pleasant View, she continued, immediately adding quaintly, but not to Varying Views. And then she went on, Beloved, some of you have come long distances to kneel with us in sacred silence, in blessed communion, unity of faith, understanding, prayer, and praise, and to return in joy, bearing your sheaves with you. In parting, I repeat to these dear members of my church, trust in truth, and have no other trusts. The following year, the church at Concord was completed, and at the time of the annual meeting, Mrs. Eddy addressed an invitation to the members attending to come out to Concord and see the new church. In the afternoon, Monday, June 13, 1904. There was no indication in the invitation that Mrs. Eddy expected to be present, but an interesting little ceremony had evidently been planned beforehand. Punctually, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Mrs. Eddy started out from Pleasant View on her daily drive. She took her usual route towards the courthouse. The town was thronged with visitors, and as she passed the lawn of the Unitarian Church and the high school and other vantage points, she was received with cheers and waving handkerchiefs. Her carriage came to a standstill on North State Street, and she was greeted on behalf of the church by the president, Mr. E.P. Bates, to whom she presented a little rosewood box containing a gavel, which, as an enclosed note explained, had been made from a tree grown on her father's farm at Bow. It was a great day for Concord, and as was the case with all these pilgrimages, it was made a civic occasion. A few days afterwards, Mrs. Eddy wrote to the Concord newspapers, expressing her gratitude to all concerned for the welcome which had been extended to the members of her church. She spoke simply of the pleasure it had all given her. It was a glad day for me, sweet to observe with what unanimity my fellow citizens vied with each other to make the Christian Scientists' short stay so pleasant. And so Mrs. Eddy, at 83, could settle back with the thought that the earth was, at least, beginning to help the woman. There was much to be done. About this time, it became evident that the Mother Church building in Boston, less than 10 years old, was quite inadequate to accommodate even its local congregation. It was necessary to hold additional services on Sundays, and at the time of the annual meeting, one of the largest halls in the city had to be requisitioned to accommodate the visitors. Early in 1902, Mrs. Eddy sent a letter to the board of directors suggesting that they give the matter their careful consideration. And at the annual meeting in June, a resolution was taken pledging any part of $2 million for the purpose of acquiring additional land and enlarging the Mother Church so as to accommodate at least 5,000 people. No sooner was the need made known generally through the Sentinel and the Journal than money began to flow in from all parts of the world. In October of 1903, sufficient sums had been secured to acquire the necessary land and commence the work of clearing it. Early in 1904, the foundation stone was laid, and for the next 2 years, the great structure was in building. Fashioned of Bedford stone and granite, its huge dome, which still dominates the sky, rose to a height of 224 feet, higher by 1 foot than the Bunker Hill Monument. In the late spring of 1906, the building was completed and the dedicatory ceremonies were set for Sunday, June 10th. Nothing in the history of the Christian Science movement, it may be ventured, served to awaken public attention all over the world to the fact and the growth of Christian Science more than the building of the Mother Church Extension, or Annex, as it has come to be called. Nothing quite like it had ever been seen before. There were no appeals for money in the ordinary sense of the word, no suggestion of a bonded indebtedness, and long before the church was completed, notices to the effect that no more subscriptions were desired were inserted in both the Journal and the Sentinel. Newspaper men, especially, were impressed by this fact more than any other. The spontaneity of the whole thing made it clear to these men, accustomed as they were to witnessing the struggles of other denominations to raise sufficient funds for anything connected with their work, that Christian Science evidently contained some incentive to action not shared by all religious bodies. When the day for the dedication of the great structure came, the acclaim from the press was complete and almost unanimous. Long before the dedication date, railway companies throughout the country had announced special excursion rates to Boston, and most of them ran special trains. So great, indeed, was the influx that between 30,000 and 40,000 Christian Scientists were in Boston, ready to attend the ceremonies. It is, of course, difficult to be sure of such figures, but the fact that the new building held between 5,000 and 6,000 people, that the dedication ceremonies were repeated 6 times in the course of the day, and that the building was filled to overflowing at each service, seems to argue that the estimate of 40,000 was not far from the truth. Each of the 6 services was the same, and of the simplest character, the main feature being the reading of the dedicatory message from Mrs. Eddy. This message was dated from Pleasant View the day before, June 9th, and in many ways, while characterized by a quite remarkable restraint, was an appeal of conciliation to all those who had so vigorously opposed her in the past. A genuine Christian Scientist, she said, loves Protestant and Catholic, D.D. and M.D., loves all who love God good, and He loves his enemies. It was also a message of thanks to each and every one who had helped to bring their hopes to fruition. Beloved, she said, I am not with you in propria persona at this memorial dedication and communion season, but I am with you in spirit and in truth, lovingly thanking your generosity and fidelity, and saying virtually what the prophet said, continue to choose whom ye will serve. And then, looking backwards upon herself and upon the little church which had been the original building, she added, the modest edifice of the Mother Church of Christ Scientist began with the cross. Its excelsior extension is the crown. The room of your leader remains in the beginning of this edifice, evidencing the praise of babes and the word which proceedeth out of the mouth of God. Its crowning ultimate rises to a mental monument, a superstructure high above the work of men's hands, even the outcome of their hearts, giving to the material a spiritual significance, the speed, beauty, and achievements of goodness. At each service was sung one of her hymns, the same one, Shepherd, show me how to go. It had been played on the bells before the first service in the early morning and before each of the five thereafter, and in the course of the day it was sung by 30,000 people or more. Mary Baker Eddy was not a great poet, or even a poet at all in the strict sense of the word, but she was a genuine hymn writer. Her harshest critics have been compelled to silence before o'er-weighting harp strings of the mind, or Saw Ye My Savior, O Gentle Presence, or Shepherd, show me how to go. So, when day grows dark and cold, tear or triumph harms, lead thy lambkins to the fold, take them in thine arms. Feed the hungry, heal the heart, till the morning's beam, white as wool, ere they depart, Shepherd, wash them clean. If the dedication of the new church roused the press to special interest in all manner of articles and editorial comment, this was nothing to the discussion evoked by the series of testimony meetings which were held throughout Boston on the following Wednesday evening. There was no attempt on this occasion to accommodate everyone desiring to attend in the new church by having a series of meetings throughout the day. The meeting was held in the Mother Church edifice at 8 o'clock in the evening, but it had overflow meetings in practically every hall of any size throughout the city. At each of these meetings, those desiring to testify were asked to introduce themselves simply by announcing the city from which they came. It must have been a memorable scene, for in good, bad, indifferent, and broken English came out the cities of the world, from Moscow to Los Angeles, and so on west to Moscow again, with voices welling up from down under all the way. And they bore testimony to the healing of all manner of disease. Zion's Herald, perhaps, most nearly summed up the effect of it all on a large cross-section of public thought when it described the whole development as audacious, stupendous, and inexplicable. In these weeks of June 1906, Mrs. Eddy was, doubtless, the most discussed woman in the world. She must have distrusted tear or triumph, but triumph more than tears. She had grown accustomed to storm, and to her there was perhaps something even ominous in this loud acclaim.